You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 124, My Blood for the Emperor. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters for making all this possible. And, as always, I'd like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. The show has just turned 8 years old, and the lowest tier of membership is still the same price it was when we started, just $2 a month. Keeping the price so low only works if we keep getting a steady stream of new members. So visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon and sign up to help me keep this thing going. Anyway, we spent last episode catching up on some of the secondary fronts of the War of the Fifth Coalition. By late spring of 1809, France's Army of Italy was crossing the Alps into Austria. Northern Italy had been secured, no thanks to the mediocre leadership of Napoleon's stepson, Eugène de Beauharnais. They would soon join the Emperor and the Grande Armée on the banks of the Danube. In the former Austrian province of Tyrol, a colorful movement of reactionary peasant rebels had seized control of the province from their Bavarian overlords. The surprising success of the rebellion had already secured it a place in legends and folk songs, but if they hoped to succeed, they would need to link up with Habsburg forces. To the east, the Austrian invasion of the Grand Duchy of Warsaw was overextended and bogged down. The Polish commander, Prince Józef Poniatowski, decided to seize the opportunity. He was leading his forces south in an invasion of Austrian Galicia, hoping to spark an uprising among the local Polish patriots. We are now more or less up to date with the last event we covered in the main narrative, Napoleon's first real significant defeat at the Battle of Aspern-Essling. As you may recall from episode 121, before Aspern-Essling, the French had not crossed the Danube all at once, but in two stages. First from the Vienna side of the river to the island of Lobau, then from Lobau to the far bank. In the wake of their defeat, they did not abandon Lobau. In fact, in the weeks after the battle, the island was bustling with activity. Soon, Lobau almost looked like one of the semi-permanent camps the army had built along the coast of the English Channel back in 1803 and 4. Magazines, storehouses, hospitals, and even roads were built on the island. These were mostly crude, temporary constructions, made of canvas and scraps of wood, but they were proof that the French still considered Lobau strategically important, and that meant Napoleon was planning to make another crossing of the Danube in this immediate area. This made the tasks facing the two armies quite clear. Napoleon had to find ways to avoid a repeat of Aspern-Essling, and Archduke Charles had to find ways to ensure there was a repeat performance. Napoleon's job was probably a bit easier. A battle the size of Aspern-Essling hinges on all kinds of factors. It had been close. The French had very nearly pulled off an upset victory. However, I don't think you need to be a tactical genius to pinpoint the greatest weakness of the French battle plan, relying on that single rickety bridge from Vienna to Lobau, built in haste and vulnerable to Austrian countermeasures. And you don't have to be a Napoleonic-level genius to think of the remedy. More bridges, built better, and maybe some boats, too, to intercept any barges the Austrians might send down the river and ferry troops and supplies to the far bank. Napoleon brought in more engineers, more lumber, and more prefabricated bridge parts. He also sent detachments up and down the Danube, with the mission of capturing as many boats as possible. Meanwhile, on the Austrian side, Archduke Charles's next course of action was not quite as clear. You might think he was basking in the glow of his unprecedented victory at Aspern-Essling, but that couldn't be further from the truth. As was his habit, the Archduke was counseling caution, constantly reminding his brother the Emperor and the rest of the civilian leadership that Austria was still just one major defeat away from total catastrophe. Charles always felt that he was the army's guardian, the only person of significant influence within the Austrian system who truly understood the dangers facing the empire, and the fact that the army was the only thing standing between the Habsburg dynasty and the abyss. The rest of the Austrian leadership was actually breathing much easier in this stage of the war. That might sound crazy, they were facing setbacks on every front, their heartland under occupation, including the capital, and Napoleon was clearly preparing for another crossing of the Danube. But the Austrian leadership had taken heart after the victory at Aspern-Essling. Tyrol was in revolt, the Iberians were still resisting doggedly, and they had important news from their most important ally. The British were planning to open a new front of the war in the Netherlands, with one of the largest amphibious military operations in history. Despite Archduke Charles's warnings, the prevailing mood within the Austrian court was optimistic. All they had to do was hold on, and the tides of war would swing back to their favor. At Aspern-Essling, the army had proven it could stand up to Napoleon. For the first time since the opening weeks of the war, they felt there was a viable path to the final victory. In reality, Archduke Charles was obviously right. If the main Habsburg field army was lost, it wouldn't matter what the British did in the Netherlands or the Spanish and Portuguese did in Iberia. There would be nothing stopping Napoleon from occupying all the Habsburg realms and dictating terms for peace, much as he had to the Prussians 3 years earlier. The war was at a critical juncture, but the rest of the Austrian leadership seems to have preferred to look on the sunny side. In fact, some in the court had been pressuring Charles to go on the offensive, cross the Danube himself, and attempt to retake the Austrian heartland. Charles and his staff debated how best to hold off the French when they crossed the Danube again. The Archduke himself believed Napoleon would strike north from Lobau, as he had before the Battle of Aspern-Essling. That triangle of ground behind the two towns was still the best available bridgehead for the French, so why wouldn't they use it again? He wanted to build a series of trenches and fortifications in this area, so the Habsburg army could meet the French in roughly the same place. But this time, rather than attacking the bridgehead, they would wait for Napoleon to come to them, force the Grande Armée to attack a strong, prepared position, if they hoped to break out and advance beyond the bridgehead. Some of his staff officers disagreed. They favored a position further back from the river, centered on a place called the Wagram Plateau, where there were two ridge lines roughly in an upside-down V-shape. Napoleon would have to neutralize this position if he hoped to advance beyond the river, and attacking one ridge line would mean exposing the flank of the Grande Armée to the other ridge line. This strategy would also be more flexible. It could work wherever the French chose to cross, whereas the Archduke's plan would only work if the French chose to cross to the north. However, Charles was the commander-in-chief, and so, while the French gathered boats and engineering supplies and built out their base on Lobau, the Habsburg field army on the opposite bank busied itself digging trenches and building field fortifications around Aspern and Essling. And so, there was a lull in the action, as both armies worked diligently to prepare for the next round of fighting. Weeks passed, with constant activity on both sides of the Danube, but no combat to speak of. During this pause in the fighting, both commanders were able to bring up reinforcements and fresh recruits to replace the losses of Aspern-Essling. Soon, both armies had swelled to well over 100,000 men. If you'll think back to our early episodes on the War of the First Coalition, we were sometimes discussing battles in which fewer than 50,000 men were engaged. At the beginning of the First Italian Campaign, Napoleon's Army of Italy probably included just barely over 20,000 soldiers. The coming confrontation between Archduke Charles and Napoleon would almost certainly involve at least 250,000 men. Bonaparte was eager for a rematch. Obviously, he wanted to wipe away the stain of defeat, but there were also practical reasons. The position of the Grande Armée was still precarious, stretched out hundreds of miles east from the French border, through hostile territory. He had the Tyrolean insurgents in his rear, and who knows what headaches might ensue if that rebellion spread to other provinces. There was also still the worry that the Prussians might join the war. However, the emperor did not rush things. He had learned from his mistakes at Aspern-Essling. The Grande Armée would not cross the Danube again until everything was ready. A month passed. More boats were gathered, more reinforcements brought in, and more supplies stockpiled. Spring turned into summer. Finally, in early July, 6 weeks after the Battle of Aspern-Essling, Bonaparte was finally ready to make another move. In a bulletin to the Grande Armée, Napoleon boasted that they had finally conquered the river. Quote, "For the French army, the Danube no longer exists." End quote. Bonaparte spent a lot of time on the banks of Lobau Island, usually dressed in the uniform of a common soldier and carrying a musket to hide his identity. One day, a group of soldiers from the Kingdom of Baden had stopped their patrol on the riverbank to cook a pot of soup for lunch. They were surprised when the emperor himself sidled up to their campfire and asked for a bowl. In these explorations, Napoleon was able to confirm with his own eyes that Archduke Charles was expecting another battle around Aspern and Essling, directly north of the island. He placed a significant artillery battery on the north shore of the island to fire on this area, as if they were softening it up for an attack. Hopefully, this would keep the Archduke's focus on Aspern-Essling, while the French conducted their actual crossing to the east, where they would be able to establish a bridgehead without having to worry about those tough, prepared defenses the Austrians had been building for the past 6 weeks. Then Bonaparte would hook around the eastern flank of the Austrian army. This would also have the benefit of driving a wedge between Charles and a potential source of reinforcements, the remains of Archduke John's army, which had invaded Italy at the beginning of the war, and were somewhere to the east. Napoleon would obviously prefer to face Charles alone. The crossing of the Danube would be an almost unbelievable feat of engineering. Entire divisions would be ferried across by boat. At Aspern-Essling, the French had two bridges, one from the Vienna side to Lobau, and one from Lobau to the far bank. This time, there would be more than a dozen. One of the bridges was to be fully built out on dry land, perpendicular to the crossing point, then swung 90 degrees across the water when the day came. An almost incredible idea when you keep in mind that the French had no source of power other than the muscles of their soldiers and draft animals. On July 1st, everything was finally ready. The units of the Grande Armée stirred from their camps and began assembling on Lobau Island and along the western bank of the Danube to prepare for the long-awaited crossing. Napoleon had personally planned this stage of the operation meticulously. This scene easily could have devolved into chaos. Nearly 200,000 men, all crammed together in a confined space, all eager to get across the river and get this ordeal over with. But great care had been taken to ensure every officer knew just where he and his men were supposed to be. There were only a small handful of minor mistakes. Of course, the Austrians had been waiting for this day for over a month, just like the French. Their lookouts on the eastern bank detected these movements almost immediately. Archduke Charles was still under the impression the main French crossing would occur near Aspern and Essling, and he began moving his troops towards that pre-prepared defensive line to face the French on the same battlefield a second time. Not everyone in the Austrian leadership agreed. In fact, this decision was so controversial that one of the Archduke's corps commanders, Baron Johann von Hiller, abruptly resigned. It was highly unusual for a commander of this era to take such a drastic step when a major battle was obviously imminent. However, as we've seen in past episodes, Hiller was actually a pretty poor leader, so perhaps the Austrian army was now better off. As French troops began crossing to the far bank, it became increasingly clear that Charles had been mistaken. Napoleon was concentrating most of his forces east of the Aspern-Essling battlefield. The small number of French troops who had returned to this area had only done so to maintain the ruse. The Austrian battle plan was spoiled. From this eastern bridgehead, Napoleon would be able to instantly outflank their prepared defenses. The Austrians would have to find somewhere else to make their stand. Unfortunately for the Habsburgs, there was no other good defensive position anywhere close to the river. Beyond their prepared defensive line was an area known as the Marchfeld, a clear rolling plain that was so perfectly flat the Austrian army used it for drill and maneuvers during peacetime. With Napoleon's massive superiority in cavalry, fighting the French on the Marchfeld would be a recipe for disaster. And so Charles finally had no choice but to listen to those staff officers who had been urging him to make his stand on the edge of the Wagram Plateau. There were sound reasons to choose this spot. They would be looking down on the French from the heights. There was also the added protection of a small stream at the base of the heights, known as the Rusbach Stream, which would slow down any attackers and break up their formations as they made the final approach. The Austrian forces would be arranged roughly in an upside-down V formation, with their left flank on the Wagram Plateau facing south towards the Danube, and their right flank along a series of smaller hills facing roughly perpendicular to the river, with a village called Otterklaa anchoring the hinge point where the two flanks met. It was a strong position, and if Napoleon attacked the left, he would expose his own flank to the right, and vice versa. The big disadvantage from the Austrian perspective was that, unlike at Aspern-Essling, the French would not be fighting with their backs to the river. The Habsburg forces would have to push very far into Napoleon's rear if they hoped to threaten the French bridges. In any case, the time for debating the merits of these plans had long passed. The French were already across the river in force. The Austrians now had no choice but to redeploy to the Wagram position. Archduke Charles left one of his corps along the Danube to delay the French and act as a rearguard, while the rest of his army prepared for the main battle along the heights. An unseasonable summer rain blew in, perfect weather for the French. The storm was bad enough to camouflage their movements, but not so bad that it hampered the crossing. Troops from 4th Corps under Marshal André Masséna and 2nd Corps under General Nicolas Oudinot were the first to cross. As they engaged the Austrian rearguard, every cannon in the massed batteries on Lobau Island opened up on the Habsburg positions along the riverbank. A few days before the battle, Masséna had fallen from his horse and injured one of his legs. He couldn't walk or ride a horse without intense pain. As we've seen many times in past episodes, Masséna was an energetic leader who preferred to stay close to the action, and so he had a small open-air carriage prepared to drive him around as he commanded his corps. This would be a strange and somewhat comical presence throughout the coming battle, Masséna reclining in his little carriage, drawn by 4 white horses, looking like a tourist as he cruised around the battlefield. The Austrian troops fought bravely, and there were several sharp skirmishes, but the French were crossing too quickly, and the concentrated artillery fire from Lobau was overwhelming. Masséna and Oudinot had little trouble pushing them aside. When Napoleon was informed that the Austrians were falling back, he remarked, quote, "Those gentlemen over there do not know how to make war. The activity of the French always confounds them," end quote. With nearly 200,000 Austrian troops lying in wait in tough positions, the army was hoping he was right. Under darkened skies and pounding rain, thousands of blue-jacketed troops were ferried across the river, and the French engineers rushed to put their bridges into place. It came time to swing that pre-built bridge into position. Napoleon asked the captain in charge how long the process would take. The officer told him 15 minutes. The emperor responded that he had 5. Despite Napoleon's time constraints, the bridge swung into position on the first try. Cheers erupted from the assembled engineers, and soon men and horses were crossing to the far bank. Meanwhile, the Austrians were now mostly deployed in their new position at Wagram. They tried to dig entrenchments, but were hampered by bad weather and rough terrain. Archduke Charles sent messengers to his brother, Archduke John, apprising him of the situation and ordering him to march towards Wagram with all possible haste. If all went well, John would arrive just in time to slam into Napoleon's right flank. Charles's message to his younger brother left no doubt about the stakes of the coming struggle. Quote, "The battle here on the Marchfeld will determine the fate of our dynasty. Your Grace will certainly wish to take part. I request that you march here at once, leaving behind all baggage and impediments, and join my left wing." End quote. Meanwhile, the French crossing continued like clockwork. All those weeks of meticulous planning and preparation were paying huge dividends. Napoleon and his staff officers excelled at this type of work, and at these crucial days, all their skills were on display. While Napoleon supervised the crossing, Massena and Oudinot savaged the Austrian rearguard. This force had been intended to delay the French, then make a fighting retreat as they fell back to join the rest of the Habsburg Field Army. But they found it impossible to disengage, and as more and more French troops crossed the river, they were increasingly outnumbered and under pressure from every side. The Habsburg rearguard suffered thousands of casualties before they finally reached the safety of their own lines. By late in the morning of July 5, 1809, Napoleon was able to start deploying his forces opposite the main Austrian positions, in preparation for the battle to begin in earnest. There was nothing complicated about this deployment. The French and Allied forces would be in a rough arc, mirroring the bend in the Austrian position. Davout's vaunted Third Corps, arguably Napoleon's best regular troops under his best commander, would hold the extreme right of the French position, then Oudinot and Second Corps to his left. The foreign contingents would be in the center, a corps of mixed French and Saxon troops under Marshal Bernadotte, and the Army of Italy under General MacDonald and Napoleon's stepson, Eugène de Beauharnais. Marshal Massena and Fourth Corps, made up mostly of veteran French troops, anchored the left flank. As always, the Imperial Guard was kept in reserve, along with a large contingent of cavalry. With nearly a 250,000 men deployed on both sides, this was a very large battlefield, more than 20 kilometers or 12.5 miles wide. And with both armies in a curved formation, the front line was actually quite a bit longer than that. Much of the area occupied by the French was wheat fields. This being July, the stalks of wheat were tall, up to the shoulder, according to one source. This was no serious impediment to the movements of Napoleonic-era troops. Once they started maneuvering over this landscape, the wheat would just be trampled into the ground. But much of the fighting would take place behind this somewhat unusual backdrop of golden wheat fields. It was around 5 in the evening by the time Napoleon had most of his forces arranged to his satisfaction. It was summertime, so there were still hours of daylight left, but it looked like the action would commence in earnest the next day, July 6th. In fact, Archduke Charles and his staff were already busy planning for the next day's fighting. However, Napoleon was weighing a somewhat reckless maneuver. An immediate attack on these tough positions, with practically no time to prepare or soften them up with artillery fire, and only about 4 hours left until sunset. There was logic to this idea. The French army was more numerous and more concentrated. The French had guessed Archduke John was on his way with reinforcements. Better to hit the Austrians now before they arrived. He also worried Archduke Charles might retreat in the night, delaying their confrontation and prolonging the war. If the Austrians were planning to retreat, attacking now might force them to stay put. He would not order an all-out assault. That was too risky even for a gambler like Napoleon. But he ordered his corps commanders along the right flank to make a reconnaissance in force. Launch probing attacks on the Austrian position. And so, somewhat surprisingly, at around dinner time, the French drummers beat out the signal to advance, and assault columns began to march towards those imposing positions. The Battle of Wagram had begun. General Oudinot's troops were first to the attack. They fought well, but found it difficult to make headway against such tough positions. The Austrians fought with almost superhuman bravery. The Habsburg commander in this sector, Count Ignaz von Hardegg, would be awarded the Cross of the Military Order of Maria Theresa for his efforts on this day, the highest honor bestowed by the Habsburg monarchy. De Vaux was usually a precise and exacting commander. However, for whatever reason, on this evening, he was late in getting his corps into action. He and Oudinot were supposed to attack together, but by the time De Vaux's Third Corps actually got moving, Oudinot had already been repulsed. However, the attacks on the center left of the Habsburg line were going well. Marshal Bernadotte sent his Saxon regiments against the town of Adderklaa, addressing them as they marched forward. Quote, "Soldiers, do you want to earn laurels too? Hurry up, or you will be too late." End quote. The Saxons cheered, and the town of Adderklaa was secured after a short, sharp fight. It looks like this somewhat spur-of-the-moment plan might actually succeed in breaking the Austrian position. However, the poor coordination of the French attack gave the Austrians enough breathing space to respond. Archduke Charles pulled several units from his left, where Oudinot's assault had already been defeated, and personally led them in a counterattack, striking units from the Army of Italy. Unfortunately for the French, this counterattack slammed right into Eugène's least experienced and least disciplined Italian regiments. The surprised Italians disintegrated. Formations broke apart as panicked men ran for the rear. According to one source, they didn't stop running until they encountered units of the Imperial Guard in the reserve. Another source claims some men ran all the way back to the Danube bridges, several miles behind the French rear. Most of the units in this area held firm, but the sudden rout of these few Italian regiments completely destroyed the momentum of the attack in this sector. A French officer would later recall, quote, "I have never seen such carnage. The field was covered with dead," end quote. Now the fighting centered on the village of Adderklaa. This was one of the most important locations on the battlefield. As we saw at the Battle of Aspernessling, these little Danube villages could be incredibly strong defensive positions, and Adderklaa stood almost exactly at the hinge point between the two flanks of the Habsburg army. Just like at Aspernessling, there was bitter street fighting. However, a somewhat strange problem soon revealed itself. Adderklaa was mostly held by Bernadotte's Saxon troops. Most units of the Royal Saxon Army wore white uniforms with black hats, just like the standard uniform of the Habsburg forces. And obviously the Saxon troops and officers spoke German, which was also the standard language in the Habsburg forces. It was getting late on a gray, rainy day. Visibility was not good. Add to that the inherent chaos of urban combat, and the troops fighting in and around Adderklaa were finding it impossible to tell friend from foe. While his men were struggling to hold on to the last of their gains, Marshal Bernadotte was, as always, concerned about his reputation. He began bad-mouthing the Emperor's battle plan to anyone who would listen. Exactly what Bernadotte said has been discussed and debated ever since, but the core of his rant was an assertion that Napoleon had been foolish in ordering an attack under these conditions, and if Bernadotte had been in command of the Grande Armée, he would have forced Archduke Charles to surrender without a shot fired by means of a, quote, "scientific maneuver," end quote. Talking like this about the commander-in-chief during a battle was a major breach of military etiquette, and of course Napoleon was not just any commander-in-chief. Even in the thick of battle, the officers of the Grande Armée loved to gossip, and soon everyone in the army was talking about how Bernadotte had disrespected the emperor. Meanwhile, the tragically confused struggle for Adderklaa continued. Bernadotte sent in fresh reinforcements, but they seemed to have been misinformed about the state of the fighting, believing they had been ordered to take a town held by hostile forces, rather than reinforce the village's defenders. And so they stormed into the town with bayonets fixed and guns blazing, killing dozens of their fellow Saxons before realizing their mistake. When night fell, the Saxons held the town, but there had been hundreds of unnecessary casualties due to friendly fire. It was around 11 p.m. by the time the fighting finally stopped. It had not been a good showing by the French. The troops had fought well, but their leaders had let them down. Both Oudinot and Bernadotte had gotten carried away and committed too many of their forces to what was supposed to be a limited probing attack. In spite of this, the courage and skill of the French troops had nearly brought success, but in the end, their efforts had amounted to almost nothing. The Austrian leadership weren't terribly pleased with their army's performance either. Several units had broken and routed almost as soon as they came under pressure from the French. Had it not been for the superb leadership of key Habsburg officers, their line might easily have been broken. They had been defending strong defensive positions against uncoordinated, limited attacks. It should not have been that close. As darkness covered the battlefield, the soldiers bedded down for an uneasy rest in their positions, and the staff officers and senior leadership of both armies gathered to plan the next day of fighting. By this point, Bonaparte was exhausted. He had stayed up all through the two previous nights, personally supervising the crossing of the Danube. The coming day, July 6th, would be his fourth in a row without a full night of sleep. As we've discussed in past episodes, Napoleon was adept at catching up on sleep when he could, grabbing little naps throughout the day. But 4 days without proper, uninterrupted rest must surely take a toll. He pulled up a chair by one of the campfires at Army headquarters and closed his eyes, almost immediately half asleep. However, he had left orders that he was to be roused by each senior officer who came in to report, and so the Emperor passed the night somewhere between work and rest. He spent the most time with Marshal Davout. Davout's Third Corps, on the extreme right of the French position, would be integral to his plans. Napoleon dispatched cavalry to the east to keep an eye out for Archduke John's approaching army and delay them if necessary. Meanwhile, Davout would attempt to turn the left flank of the Habsburg army, thus, hopefully, separating the Austrians from any reinforcements coming from the east and compromising their key position on the Wagram Plateau. Davout's main attack on the extreme right would be supported by large attacks on other parts of the Wagram Plateau. Hopefully, the Austrians would be forced to commit their reserves and pull troops from other parts of the battlefield to stabilize their left flank. Then the Army of Italy would punch through the center, breaking the enemy position and cutting their army in two. On the other side of the lines, Archduke Charles was making plans of his own. As Napoleon tried to infer what his counterpart might be thinking, he was actually missing a crucial piece of information. French intelligence had vastly overestimated the size of Archduke John's approaching army. John's forces had sustained so many losses on their long, difficult retreat from Italy that they no longer really qualified as an army. Napoleon was under the impression John had about 30,000 men. In fact, the real number might have been as low as 13,000. Napoleon believed Archduke Charles intended to hold his position until his brother could arrive to turn the tide of the battle. In fact, Charles knew that John's force was probably too small to play a decisive role in the coming struggle, and that even if he did arrive in time to deploy his entire command, the Habsburg forces would still be outnumbered. Under these circumstances, playing the waiting game was actually not really an option for Charles. Despite his army's strong positions, he felt they were actually in grave danger, maybe even staring defeat in the face. And so, he would attempt to do something bold and surprising. Just before dawn, the whole Habsburg army would sweep down from the heights in a coordinated attack all along the line. This would be a big risk. They would be outnumbered, fighting without the advantage of those strong positions. But it would be the last thing Napoleon expected. With their units arranged in that upside-down V formation around the French army, there would be an opportunity to envelop the Grande Armée, possibly even threaten their bridges over the Danube. As you might imagine, this plan was controversial. The Habsburg leadership debated long into the night before it was finally adopted. Charles wanted to get his forces moving before dawn, Part of the point of this strategy was to preempt whatever Napoleon was planning. With the summer sun rising early, that meant the Habsburg forces would have to get moving very quickly. The Archduke's plan envisioned everyone attacking all at once, over 100,000 men across that huge front. The relatively new Austrian staff system was facing the daunting task of planning and coordinating all these movements, drawing up new orders for the entire army, and getting them into the hands of the senior leadership, with only a few hours left before sunrise. There was movement within the French lines as well, Napoleon concentrating more of his forces in the center and along his right flank, where he expected to make the main effort in the morning. There was also an unauthorized maneuver. In the center, Marshal Bernadotte did not like his position. The French army was deployed roughly in the shape of an arrowhead, with Bernadotte's forces near the point. With his furthest forward units occupying the strategically important village of Otterclaw. Surveying the battlefield, the prideful marshal believed most of the action the next day would occur along the flanks, which would mean Otterclaw was nowhere near as important as it looked at first glance, and that his forward units might actually be dangerously overextended. And so Bernadotte took it upon himself to shorten his line, abandoning Otterclaw, which his Saxon units had fought over with such intensity the day before. There was nothing inherently wrong with this idea. In fact, some historians have argued Bernadotte was quite correct. However, he had no orders from Napoleon to make this move, and he did not even bother informing the emperor of what he had done. Right or wrong, this was insubordination, and insubordination at this scale in the middle of a major battle put the entire army at risk. As the army commanders made their plans, the officers and soldiers of both sides got what rest they could and braced themselves for a hellish day in the morning. The storm had subsided, but the night was cold. Soldiers on both sides commented that it was strangely still and quiet. Unlike other multi-day battles we've covered on the show, there was practically no skirmishing between the infantry. The lines were too far apart, and the night was too dark. The only sound was the constant rumble of distant thunder, as that storm rolled deeper into Bohemia, and cannon blasts, as the artillery of both sides fought a long-distance duel in the dark. It was a foreboding atmosphere. A German soldier fighting for Napoleon said that it was something out of Macbeth. As was always the case when serious fighting was imminent, some were racked by dread. As we've discussed in past episodes, officers and soldiers of this era often had premonitions of death on the eve of combat. Surprisingly, at Wagram, one of these was the celebrated Hussar general Antoine de La Salle, one of the most colorful characters in the army, which is really saying something in a force that was famous for its flamboyant and larger-than-life officers. La Salle was usually vigorous and outgoing, a man who lived life like it was all a big joke, and he was the only one who knew the punchline. But on the night of July 5th, 1809, he was somber and pensive. As he rose to go to bed, he told one of his aides, quote, "I will not survive this day," end quote. He went back to his tent and wrote two letters, one to Napoleon, asking him to provide financial support to his family should the worst happen, and another to his wife, saying goodbye, only to be delivered in case of his death. To the east, Archduke John was preparing for the next day's march towards the battlefield with the remnants of his army. Unfortunately for the Austrians, he was still nowhere close. His older brother's order to march towards Wagram had arrived late, hampered by poor weather and bad roads. Once he finally got the message, John had been slow and clumsy in moving his units. As we've discussed in past episodes, John is generally regarded as an incompetent commander, who never would have been entrusted with an army had he not been born the son of an emperor. Still, Napoleon had no way of knowing this. He had reports from his cavalry units east of the battlefield indicating that none of them had encountered approaching Austrian forces, but as we saw at Aspern-Essling, sometimes the scouts got it wrong. The second day of action started before dawn on July 6th. Archduke Charles had envisioned his whole army advancing together just before daybreak, but the Habsburg officers had only had a few hours to disseminate the Archduke's orders, get their men into position, and make their preparations. No surprise, almost everyone was running late. When the hour came for the offensive to begin, only one corps of the army was actually ready, that of Prince Franz of Orsini-Rosenberg, positioned on the extreme left of the Austrian line, opposite Marshal Davout. Ironically, Napoleon's plan had also called for the day's battle to begin in this sector, but instead of Davout attacking, he found himself on the defensive against a large enemy force, over 15,000 strong. Bonaparte was eating his breakfast when he began to hear the sounds of musket volleys and cannon fire from the east. He immediately began soliciting reports from the units on the extreme right, and soon came to the erroneous conclusion that Archduke John's army had arrived and was attempting to turn his right flank. Napoleon began sending reinforcements to support Davout, under the impression that Prince Rosenberg's attack was just the first stage of a major offensive. French horse artillery and cavalry were first on the scene. They were able to deploy to the east, menacing Rosenberg's flank as he attempted to push into Davout's position. Meanwhile, other Austrian units in this sector had not even reached their starting positions. Rosenberg's corps was fighting totally alone, and as we've seen many times in the past, isolated attacks against significant enemy formations stood little chance of success. Frustrated, Archduke Charles canceled the offensive in this sector, ordering Prince Rosenberg to fall back. However, as the prince's corps began shuffling backwards, Davout ordered Third Corps to counterattack immediately. Remember, they had been planning to launch their own offensive before the fighting began, and despite the morning surprise, they were ready to push back. Rosenberg was forced to execute a difficult fighting retreat, losing hundreds of men in the process. Soon, Davout and Rosenberg's units were roughly back to where they had been before the attack started. Davout stopped to redeploy his forces for a proper attack, and the fighting in this sector petered out, for the time being. On the French right flank, Archduke Charles's grand offensive was over before it had really begun. Napoleon was among the units on the right flank of his army. A French officer would later recall, quote, "The Emperor coursed along the front of the line of battle at a gallop, his arm extended towards the Wagram Heights, showing the army the position it would take. The spectacle was magnificent. I do not think that one could see a more beautiful military tableau." End quote. However, it would be some time before the French assailed the heights again. The Habsburg attack was not over. On other parts of the battlefield, there were Austrian units attacking as ordered. In the center, Marshal Heinrich von Bellegarde had sent his troops forward just after Rosenberg's attack began. Their main objective was the town of Adrarklaw, the most important strategic position in this part of the battlefield. Entrenchments had been dug around the town, and the stone and brick buildings were imposing. Many of the Habsburg troops could remember the tough urban combat at Aspern-Essling. They must have been bracing themselves for a bloody fight. Imagine how relieved they must have been to discover Marshal Bernadotte had abandoned the town in the night. The Austrians took this valuable position without firing a shot. It was only now, several hours into the second day of battle, that Napoleon learned that Adrarklaw had been abandoned. He was furious. Marshal Bernadotte's comments from the previous evening, claiming he would have broken the enemy position without a shot fired by means of a scientific maneuver, had already gotten back to Napoleon, so he was even less pleased with Bernadotte than usual. Bonaparte had been angered by Bernadotte's antics in the past, but the prideful marshal had really outdone himself this time. But for the moment, Napoleon focused entirely on correcting the situation in the center. He sent orders to Bernadotte and to Massena, whose 4th Corps held the position to Bernadotte's left, telling them to retake the town at any cost. Massena's men stormed the Austrian positions outside Adrarclaw, and faced with a sudden, determined attack by a large number of experienced French regulars, the Austrians broke and began running back to Adrarclaw itself, to seek shelter in the buildings and narrow streets and alleys. Those fleeing Austrians effectively screened the advance of their French pursuers, allowing the men of 4th Corps to run right into the town without taking very much fire from the garrison. The situation inside Adrarclaw was chaotic and confused. The streets were clogged with panicked Austrian soldiers and advancing French attackers. The defenders found it almost impossible to open fire without hitting their own men. The confusion worked to the advantage of the French, and soon the town was retaken. Massena's men had now been joined by Bernadotte's Saxons, and together they tried to push their advantage and advance past the town into the Austrian center. However, they were torn apart by musket fire as soon as they left the safety of the buildings. By now, both army commanders were galloping towards the center of the battlefield. Archduke Charles arrived first, bringing with him several elite grenadier companies from the reserve. He quickly organized a counterattack and led them forward himself, smashing right into the flank of the French forces outside Adrarclaw. The French were surprised, so much so that some of Bernadotte's Saxon troops broke and ran. They sowed chaos and created an opening in the French lines. Fortunately for the French, the cavalry of 4th Corps was on hand to make an emergency charge and keep the enemy at bay while Marshal Bernadotte struggled to rebuild his line and rally his shattered Saxon regiments. It was at this key moment that Napoleon arrived on the scene and almost immediately came face to face with Bernadotte. With a key turning point of a decisive battle raging all around them, this was not a good moment for a personal confrontation between the two men, to put it mildly. But Napoleon let his anger and hatred of Bernadotte get the better of him. He gestured at Bernadotte's routing troops and said sarcastically, quote, "Is this the type of scientific maneuver with which you will force Archduke Charles to lay down his arms?" End quote. What happened next is disputed. Marcellin Marbeau, who we've quoted from in many past episodes, relates a very dramatic scene in which Napoleon actually dismissed Bernadotte on the spot. This would have been almost unprecedented, removing a corps commander right in the middle of a major battle and at a crucial moment when his troops were closely engaged with the enemy. Many historians dispute this story, and Marbeau's account seems to be the only source for it, so I won't repeat it here. In any case, with Marshal Massena's 4th Corps now heavily engaged in the center, the French left was vulnerable. 4th Corps represented essentially the entire left flank of the Grande Armée, and their attention was focused on the center. When Napoleon had arranged his forces for the second day of battle, he had anticipated the French fighting on the offensive and the Austrians remaining static in their strong positions. He planned to make his main effort on the right and in the center, so he had not bothered leaving very many troops on the left. But Archduke Charles had never called off his grand offensive in this sector, and by this point in the battle, the Austrian forces along Napoleon's left had begun their advance. The extreme left of the French line, nearest the Danube River, was only held by a single infantry division, spread out in a perilously thin line to cover so much ground. Outnumbered 3-1, they had no choice but to begin falling back as soon as they came under serious pressure. Soon, most of the 6th Corps of the Habsburg Army, led by Field Marshal Johann von Klenau, had pushed so deep into Napoleon's left flank that they had actually begun to threaten the rear of the entire French army. If this was allowed to continue, the Grande Armée's bridges over the Danube might be in jeopardy, which could easily lead to an Austrian victory, perhaps even complete catastrophe for the French. Just as the situation around Adrarclaw was being stabilized, here was another crisis demanding a response. Napoleon had planned for his forces to be on the attack, but by now it was the late morning, the battle had been raging since before dawn, and the French had done little more than respond to the Austrians. As Klenau's corps continued to advance, they passed the French staging area on Lobau Island. Napoleon had not been able to bring all his guns over the river, and so many were still deployed in their batteries along the north shore of the island. They tore bloody holes into the advancing Austrians, slowing Klenau's advance. Still, the Austrians kept coming. By around 10 in the morning, the French had been forced to abandon the town of Essling, which had seen so much bitter fighting only a few weeks earlier. The advance units of Klenau's corps were now behind the center of the Grande Armée, and only a few miles from the bridges over the Danube. Drastic action had to be taken. Napoleon did have reserves in the middle of the battlefield, but he was still hoping to use these to punch through the Austrian center, as he'd planned the night before. If he deployed these forces now against Klenau, there would be no significant body of French troops remaining for the decisive blow in the center, and thus little chance of a major victory. And so he would attempt something far riskier, shifting the entire left flank of the army. Massena would march the rest of his corps south to reinforce the single battered division holding off Klenau, and hit the left flank of that bulge Klenau had cut into the French line. The gap in the lines where Massena's right flank had once stood would be filled by a massive artillery battery, along with a few units from the Army of Italy. Massena's men were involved in heavy fighting. To complete this maneuver, they would have to somehow disengage from the enemy, then form into vulnerable march columns and expose their flank to the Austrians to march south. Then, that gap they left in the line would be an Achilles heel for the whole French position until the artillery could get set up. And so Napoleon needed something to cover this dangerous, complicated maneuver and hold the Austrians at bay until it was complete. And so he called forward Marshal Bessières, commander of the reserve cavalry, and ordered him to mass every horseman he could find for a grand charge against the Austrian center. The cavalry of the Imperial Guard was supposed to be included in this attack, but when Bessières arrived at the starting point, the Austrians were so menacing, he decided to attack immediately without waiting for the guard. Still, even without the guard, these were some of the best mounted units in Europe. Armored heavy cavalry, spearheaded by the elite carbineers, with their distinctive white cloaks and red plumes in their helmets. The armored horsemen rode forward, aiming for a small gap in the Austrian lines, a seam between the positions of two Habsburg corps. There were not very many of them, around 3,000 cavalry charging a force of infantry nearly 10 times their size. The Austrians formed up in squares and mass battalions to receive them, and under sustained musket fire, the first wave of the charge faltered. However, the French formed up and tried again. This time, they were able to pierce the enemy line and push into the rear. The cuirassier general Étienne de Nansouty saw enemy cannon to his right, a large Austrian battery that had been deployed to support their attacks on Otterclaw. The French horsemen were now roughly parallel to that line, and thus out of the cannon's field of fire. So Nansouty redirected several squadrons north. They were able to quickly overwhelm the position. The Austrian gunners scattered, running for cover, and French cuirassiers leapt from the saddle to disable the enemy cannons. By now, the mounted units of the Imperial Guard had finally begun to arrive, and seeing the charge already underway, they immediately dug in their spurs to join the melee. Marshal Bessières was moving at a gallop when he was thrown from the saddle by a near miss from an Austrian cannonball. He hit the ground hard, head first, and was instantly knocked out cold. His men rushed him off the battlefield, believing he had been killed, and command passed to General Nansouty. By now, Archduke Charles had brought forward his own cavalry reserve. They countercharged, and a fierce, chaotic melee ensued. The French horsemen were outnumbered, and their mounts were already worn out from the first phase of the charge. Soon, Nansouty only had about 1,000 men left in good order. Facing annihilation, he ordered the remains of his command to fall back. The Austrian infantry rushed to reform their lines and restart the attack, but it was too late. Massena's corps had completed their redeployment, and that massive artillery battery had been assembled to plug the gap. The cavalry had done their job. Meanwhile, to the east, along Napoleon's right flank, the fighting was heating up again. Davout's corps had taken time to recover from the hard fighting around dawn and redeploy for their big push on the Austrian left flank. Remember, Napoleon had planned on starting the day with this maneuver, but things had definitely not gone according to plan, and it was late morning before they finally got moving. They were facing tough opposition. The opposing Habsburg force, Prince Rosenberg's corps, had suffered much worse in the fighting earlier in the day, but the Austrians had the high ground. They had built field fortifications in this area before the battle had started, and their position was anchored on a small village called Markgraf Neusiedl. But Third Corps included some of the best and most experienced regular units in the whole French military. Despite the tough positions and fierce enemy resistance, they made steady progress. Marshal Davout was near the front, urging his troops onward, when his horse was hit by musket or grapeshot fire and killed instantly, collapsing to the ground and momentarily trapping the marshal underneath. Davout was so laser-focused that he seems not to have noticed. He continued to issue orders and call out to his soldiers as his aides worked to free him from under the dead horse. Soon, Third Corps was in position to strike at the town of Markgraf Neusiedl, which was the scene of the same type of intense back-and-forth urban warfare we've seen throughout this campaign. Davout believed the Austrians were wavering, so he called forward his heavy cavalry to charge the enemy. If the horsemen could punch through, it might break the entire enemy position, allowing Third Corps to push into the rear and roll up their entire left flank. But between the rough, uneven terrain and the Austrian entrenchments, it was impossible for the cavalry to build momentum, and they found their charges had nowhere to go. Nonetheless, they attacked several times to no result, losing hundreds of men in the process. Napoleon was watching Davout's progress from his position at the center of the battlefield. He could see a stone tower rising up from Markgraf Neusiedl, the remains of what had once been the town's church, and he could see that the blue, white, and red flags of Davout's units were close to it, which meant there was fighting inside the town. Third Corps was making good progress, but until the Austrians were driven completely out of the village, the left flank of their army remained reasonably secure. All the way at the other end of the battlefield, near the Danube, Marshal Massena and 4th Corps had begun their offensive into the flank of Klenau's advancing Austrians. By now, the French position was beginning to look stronger. Both armies had to deal with large enemy forces pushing into their left flanks. Napoleon had Massena's entire corps to shore up his left, but Archduke Charles had nothing with which to counter Davout. He could do little more than hope Prince Rosenberg could hold on, and that his brother would arrive on the battlefield sometime soon, and that John's relatively small force of 13,000 men could somehow turn the tide. Massena brought forward General Lasalle's cavalry, ordering them to charge Klenau and finally stop the momentum of his offensive. Remember, Lasalle had been plagued by premonitions of his death all night, but he gave no sign of it on the battlefield that day, bravely leading his men from the front, as he always had. His charge succeeded. The Austrians had no choice but to redeploy and form squares and battalion masses to repel the cavalry. Klenau had been advancing all morning, but with his men in their stationary formations and an entire French corps bearing down on them, the momentum of the attack was lost. Massena's horse artillery deployed behind the cavalry and began blasting away at the enemy formations. Massena ordered Lasalle to charge a second time. Once again, Lasalle led from the front, setting the pace of the charge, as a good cavalry commander should. He was shot in the chest and staggered momentarily, but continued to lead as if nothing had happened, urging his men onward as the blood soaked his ornate gold-braided hussar's uniform. As they made their final approach, General Lasalle was struck again, this time in the forehead, killing him instantly. LaSalle had always told his men that any hussar who wasn't dead by 30 was a coward. He had surpassed that lifespan, but not by much. The colorful general was just 34 years old. It was a good thing he had written that farewell letter to his wife the night before. It reads in part, quote, "My heart belongs to you, my blood to the emperor, and my life to honor." End quote. This was a man who loved life. He was not happy to be leaving this world, but I don't think he would have preferred to do it any other way. LaSalle's sacrifice had not been in vain. His men were eventually beaten back, but Klenau was forced to order his entire corps to make a fighting retreat. Massena's attacks had put them in a precarious position, alone, unsupported by the rest of the Habsburg army, and under severe pressure, with their backs to the Danube. There would be more hard fighting in this sector before the day was over, but the French now had the upper hand. The threat to Napoleon's left flank had passed. Archduke Charles had surprised Napoleon by attacking, and his men had fought with courage and skill. Had the Austrian assaults been better coordinated, they might have been on the verge of winning the battle. But, as things stood, the Habsburg army was now in a bad position. All their attacks had been repelled. Their left flank was losing ground to Davout, and their right flank was embroiled in a difficult fighting retreat, hounded by Massena. There were no significant reserves left to deploy. The battle was slipping through Archduke Charles's fingers. Napoleon knew it too. Around this time, he trained his spyglass on the town of Markgraf Neusiedl on the right flank. He looked to that tower, which he had been using to gauge the progress of Davout's corps. He could now see a few blue, white, and red banners beyond the tower, indicating that all or most of the town was under French control. Bonaparte sent a message to Marshal Massena, encouraging him to redouble his efforts. Quote, "The battle is won at all points." End quote. He may have been slightly exaggerating. The Austrians did still have a chance. Archduke John was on his way, but it was a very slim chance. Charles still had no idea when or where his brother would arrive, or even if he would arrive at all. And with only 13,000 men, John's army would need a lot of luck if they hoped to turn the tide of this battle. Obviously, Napoleon was quite pleased with this turn of events. He had spent almost the whole day putting out fires, responding to various crises. Now, with Davout's attack nearing its objective, he was finally ready to put the second phase of his plan into effect, a large offensive on the Austrian center, aimed at splitting their army in two. This all-important task would fall to the Army of Italy. These were not Napoleon's best troops. As we saw in our episodes on the campaign in northern Italy, their quality and performance was very uneven. Still, the enemy was spent and looking vulnerable, and there was no one else on the battlefield to make this maneuver. The attack would be led by General Etienne Macdonald, recently appointed as military advisor to young Prince Eugene, the army's nominal commander. Macdonald was an extremely capable and experienced officer. The troops may not have been Napoleon's best, but at least they had a top-notch commander leading them forward. Macdonald arranged his assault force in a somewhat unorthodox formation, ordering each battalion to form an assault column and then forming them into a rough box. He had been with these men for months. He knew their capabilities and their limitations. They struggled to move quickly in complicated formations, and they were prone to break under heavy enemy fire. This box column formation was relatively simple, and it would hopefully make each unit feel supported by those around them, thus minimizing the chance that they would falter or rout under heavy enemy fire. They would be facing tough opposition. The Austrian Third Corps, made up mostly of seasoned regulars, plus the reserve grenadiers, some of the best troops in the whole Habsburg military, backed up by plenty of artillery. As MacDonald and his men prepared for the attack, Napoleon joined them. As was his habit, he got right up close to the front lines, making his staff officers uneasy as enemy musket balls passed worryingly close by. One junior officer on his staff had a near miss. A ball struck his chaco only a few inches above his forehead. The hat went flying, and Napoleon remarked, quote, "It's a good thing you're not any taller," end quote. MacDonald's somewhat unwieldy formation began lumbering forward in the mid-afternoon, and soon came under withering artillery fire. They had brought forward a small number of their own guns, for counter-battery fire, but the Austrians neutralized them quickly, then went to work pummeling the advancing French and Italians. In their tightly packed assault columns, they made easy targets. There were supposed to be cavalry charges along the flanks of this attack to soften up and distract the enemy, but these were poorly coordinated. Several French cavalry units never received their orders, and so never advanced beyond their starting positions. The men of the Army of Italy were sitting ducks. Despite suffering horrendous casualties, they actually managed to close the distance and engaged the Austrian line, but they did not have the momentum to break through. The objective was in sight, but MacDonald's forces were melting away before his eyes. He sent back desperate calls for reinforcements. Napoleon obliged, sending in fresh units, including several from the Imperial Guard. But the French were losing too many men too quickly, and the Austrian defenders would not budge. MacDonald was forced to fall back. Napoleon had hoped this offensive would be the coup de grace, splitting the Austrians right down the middle and ensuring a decisive victory, maybe even the destruction of one or both wings of the Habsburg Field Army. MacDonald's men had done their best, but the Habsburg center would not crack. Despite the failure of the big French attack in the center, any chance of an Austrian victory was vanishing. Davout's Third Corps continued making slow but steady progress in their attack on the Austrian left. The fighting was intense, especially in and around the town of Markgraf Neusiedl. As we've seen many times in past episodes, these Austrian villages with their stone and brick buildings were incredibly formidable positions. According to one of Davout's officers, the fields around the town were completely choked with corpses. A soldier from Third Corps would later recall, quote, "I had never fired so many rounds. My musket was so hot I could not use it," end quote. Despite a heroic defense by the Habsburg troops, the last few outlying buildings of Markgraf Neusiedl eventually fell to the French, and Davout began pushing into the Austrian rear. Now, the entire Habsburg position on the Wagram Plateau was in danger of coming unraveled. Archduke Charles himself soon arrived on the scene, bringing with him a small number of reinforcements he had been able to scrape together from the center of the battlefield. He had been hoping to lead a counterattack to retake the village, but soon discovered he had nowhere close to enough manpower. The small number of troops he had brought with him were barely enough to stabilize the line. Around this time, the Archduke finally got word from his younger brother. Archduke John said his army was only a few hours away. He estimated his advance units would begin arriving on the battlefield at around 5 p.m. By now, that was only a few hours away, but it would be too late. The way things were going, by the time John would be in a position to make any kind of difference, the whole Austrian right would either be shattered by Davout's attack or forced to abandon their position. At this point, it was basically impossible to imagine the Austrians winning the battle. As we've discussed in the past, Archduke Charles's primary objective was always the preservation of the army. He would not risk its destruction waiting around for a miracle. He ordered his staff to begin organizing a retreat. This would be no mean feat. The two forces were closely engaged all along that huge front line. The smart move would have been to launch a diversionary attack, but Charles had no reserves with which to do so. Once again, the Austrian leadership had to pull off an incredibly difficult set of maneuvers, managing a massive fighting retreat across the entire front, keeping the French at bay, and making sure no unit fell back too fast or lingered too long to avoid creating gaps in the line. Meanwhile, Napoleon could sense that victory was at hand. He had already been drawing up orders for a general advance all along the line. As the Austrians began to fall back, one of Napoleon's corps commanders, General Oudinot, was overtaken by enthusiasm. He seems to have believed the enemy were routing rather than falling back in an orderly, disciplined, planned retreat. He rode out in front of his corps, urging them to immediately charge the enemy. Fortunately for the French, his subordinates restrained the men. Poor General Oudinot was shot twice and had his horse killed before his aides finally rushed him to the rear. Just like at Aspern-Essling a few weeks earlier, the Austrian artillery acquitted themselves very well in this phase of the battle, covering the retreating infantry with relentless fire, then breaking down their cannons and equipment and fleeing to the rear before the French could catch them. The battle was decided, but the fighting continued in this fashion for quite some time. It was at this point, with the Austrians defeated and the battle winding down, that Archduke John's units began to arrive on the battlefield. It was actually about 4 p.m. He had arrived about an hour earlier than he'd promised his brother, but an hour early was still too late. There were brief clashes along the extreme right and in the rear of the Grande Armée. This set off a momentary panic at Imperial headquarters. Remember, the French still believed Archduke John had around 30,000 men, and the French lines had advanced so far that there were not very many units standing between Archduke John and Bonaparte. Napoleon's personal bodyguards formed a square around him, prepared to fight to the last to protect their emperor. But once Archduke John's men learned the battle was already lost, they quickly broke off contact and began marching away from the battlefield. The Grande Armée was too exhausted to keep up the pursuit for long. By now, it had been over 24 hours since the beginning of the battle, and before that, there had been the difficult crossing of the Danube. Few in the French ranks had gotten much sleep in the night, and many had been awake the night before as well. Napoleon had deployed almost his entire force. His only remaining fresh units were 2 regiments of the Imperial Guard. The Grande Armée was spent, but they had done what they came to do. The Battle of Wagram was a French victory. Aspern-Essling was avenged, and the Danube conquered. Next episode, we'll discuss the aftermath of the Battle of Wagram, the largest battle in European history up to this point. For those of you who are signed up on Patreon, I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. Make sure to get in your questions in the comment section of the last bonus episode. As for the rest of you, I'll be back to you in 1 month with more from the main narrative. As always, thanks for listening.